Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your egg-ruining hostess, Lady P. No relation to Master P. And joining me today is our very game troop of movie fans. First up, let's welcome to the show, Martini in Hand, Queen of the Nerdists, Michelle Bushman. Welcome, Michelle.
Hey, what's up?
Also ready to do some serious acting.
Yes.
Acting.
Not as good as Gina Rollins, but we'll try.
Well, yeah. We're going to do our best, indeed. Yeah. But it's the community director of The Blacklist, Kate Hagen. Welcome, Kate.
Hello.
Hello. I love everyone's intros. Everyone responds so differently. It's great. But on today's show, we're going to embrace all of our differences and all of our varying approaches to podcasting, much like the way that John Cassavetes embraced the varying approaches to acting, right? Because today's show, we have a John Cassavetes double feature, though if you ask me, it's more like a Jenna Rollins double feature.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, we'll get there. We're talking the 183rd movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, Faces, and the 144th movie on the poll, A Woman Under the Influence. As you may have noticed, we are going out of order on the Sight and Sound list, in part because the rankings are getting increasingly arbitrary, but also because this March marks the 50th anniversary of the release of Faces, and I think that's as good a reason to revisit as any. Today we'll talk about how well it holds up, as well as Women Under the Influence, both in terms of their groundbreaking experimentalism and their emotional resonance and whatever the hell else you guys want to talk about, frankly. Okay. You guys ready to do some yelling?
Hell yeah.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Woo! Okay. Let's begin today's double feature with the John Cassavetes 1968 film, Faces. Released 50 years ago this March, the film still is best remembered for its shaggy experimental style and its bold, unpredictable performances. The film forgoes many of the trappings and conventions of a typical Hollywood picture of the era. However, it does feature a discernible linear narrative. One night, two friends, Dickie and Freddie, pick up a call girl named Jeannie, who's played by Jenna Rollins. Over the course of the evening, Dickie, played by John Marley, becomes enamored with Jeannie and proceeds to march back home and tell his wife that he wants a divorce. The film then follows as Dickie and his wife, Maria, played by Lynn Carlin, acclimate to their new lives as carefree singles. Dickie fends off rivals for Jeannie's affection, and eventually the two enjoy a night together. Meanwhile, Maria, not content to let Dickie have all the fun, gathers her middle-aged pals for a night out at the club. The women pick up a gregarious young man named Chet, played by Seymour Cassell, and take him back to Maria's place for further debauchery. Eventually, Maria's friends make their way home, giving Chet and Maria the opportunity to make it, to use the popular euphemism of the era. Of course, neither Dickie nor Maria's new loves are more than passing fancies. Maria's night proves especially disastrous, as after a brief ellipsis, we find her on the floor, lying comatose after an apparent suicide attempt. The sequence finds Chet manically attempting to resuscitate Maria, calling the paramedics, running up and down the stairs, coffee in tow. He jostles her body and slaps her face, hoping to rouse her awake. His violent desperation does eventually yield the desired result, as Maria is able to hold herself upright. However, just as Chet and Maria exchange sympathetic glances and words, Dickie walks in the room and Chet jumps out the window. While Dickie's night was perhaps less traumatic than Maria's, his relationship with Jeannie seems to be as provisional as Maria's was with Chet. Both encounters serve to stir the long-dormant volcano of grief and despair. A feeling and violence leaves a trail of destruction that can't be cleaned up or hidden beneath politeness and civility. In the end, Dickie and Maria are left together in their big empty house, revealed to each other and to themselves. Of course, this plot may seem pretty straightforward. Yeah, totally straightforward. it is delivered in a way that can only be described as histrionic, or that I can only describe as histrionic, maybe you guys will disagree, the style and performance are all pitched for maximum intensity, with the roving camera highlighting all the gestures and crevices of the actor's visages. How do you say that word?
Visage?
Is it visage or visage?
I thought visage.
I think you can go fancy, either way.
Yeah.
Let's pretend it's French.
Visage. Yeah, exactly. Visage. Michel Visage. The film made a huge impression upon its release. Been heralded as a landmark in experimental cinema, and generally has maintained this reputation within the critical community. But do our panelists think Cassavetes' experiment has stood the test of time? We shall discuss. Okay, so let's start off with everyone's just first experiences with Cassavetes. Kate, let's start with you.
So this movie was my first Cassavetes movie. I saw it when I was a sophomore in college at Columbia College.
Awesome.
I had this wonderful professor named Reed Schultz for a class called American Independent Pioneers, and the whole semester he was hyping up Cassavetes Day, and I knew who Cassavetes was, but I had never seen any of his films, and Reed in his intro for this film said, this movie will either change the way you think about film for the rest of your life, or you'll hate it, and say, why did you make us watch this? I definitely fell into the former camp. This movie really did change my life, not to be hyperbolic about it, but I saw this movie on, like, a Tuesday, and by the next Tuesday, I had rented and watched A Woman Under the Influence and Killing of a Chinese Bookie. I had seen Jenna Rollins in, like, The Notebook, I think,
yes.
And then when I saw her in this, it was just that kind of, like, love at first sight thing with actors. I was just like, oh my god, this woman is the best thing I've ever seen in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen it, watching it in prep for the podcast was the third time I had seen it. I got to see it on the big screen at the Egyptian about 2 years ago. It's interesting. I used to say this was my second favorite Cassavetes movie after Woman Under the Influence, but as time has gone on, I don't know if that's true anymore.
Number one?
It's still Woman Under the Influence, okay. But I think Opening Night has crept into the new number two
yes.
spot. Yeah.
Yes.
So wonderful. but I still really love this movie. We'll get into performances, but I think one of the issues I have seeing it more times is I don't find John Marley to be as compelling of a presence as Jenna, Lynn Carlin, or Seymour Cassell.
Mm-hmm.
But I love it. I love Cassavetes. He's my dude. If I ever make a movie, I would like it to be in this kind of verite handheld style. It's interesting to watch directors like Lynn Ramsey who've kind of taken that and pushed it forward. He's my dude.
He's your dude. I love it. Michelle?
So opposite from Kate, Cassavetes has kind of always been my blind spot. Just always mean to, oh, I'm going to watch Opening Night. Oh, I'm going to watch. I have the Criterion of Love Streams sitting in my house, unopened. I actually have the box set. That's what it is. It's the five with him. And I just haven't watched it. It's just like Coppola is my other big blind spot.
Mm.
I just saw The Godfather like 6 months ago.
Oh my god,
it's so fun!
On the Virgin, that's fantastic.
Yeah,
I kind of wish you hadn't watched it ever.
Well, like, I watched it on the big screen because I kept telling people, oh, I'm not going to watch this on a TV. Like, I feel like it's bad to watch it on TV first time. And then finally, TCM were playing it as part of like the big screen classics.
Mm.
And I went, oh, I'm going to watch it. So I feel like Cassavetes kind of feels like that to me, is like, oh, I should watch this on a big screen, but it just never keep catching it.
Mm-hmm.
So this was the first time I watched a Cassavetes movie.
All right. I love that.
So I know him from like Rosemary's Baby is one of my favorite movies. I know he was in, is it Dirty Dozen? I've seen him in Dirty Dozen. So I've seen him more as an actor than I've read about him, and I went to film school and people talk about Cassavetes all the time, but I am kind of unfamiliar with actually seeing his work.
Okay, so what was your first impression? Don't let Kate influence
you.
I liked Woman Under the Influence more than I liked Faces, but I did really like Faces. I can definitely see, like you were saying, like Lynn Ramsey taking that cinema verite style and really rolling with it. I loved Lynn Carlin the most in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she just, like, my heart broke for her her scene at the very, like, one-fourth, or last half of the movie. Her and Gina Rollins, I think, are, like, the stars of this movie. The men kind of are in the background for me. I'm like, you know, I can take it or leave it. I do like the opening with the two of them reenacting their, like, routine from school. I really like that. But I think the women of this movie are what, you know, really, like, shines for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I kind of skipped over Lynn Carlin, but I think she deserves so much praise for this.
She's so good in that role. Yeah.
And she was basically... I don't think she had been in anything else. I think this is her debut role, right?
That's wild. Yeah.
That's so crazy. She's so good in it.
And then her and Cassell were both nominated for Oscars, and this was up for screenplay as well. Is that right, I think
yeah. So, which is bizarre, because how much of it was improvised?
I wanted to talk about this. This is really interesting. At least from everything I have read, Cassavetes, the conception that a lot of that was improvised on set is actually not true. When I was at the WGA one day, I picked up the screenplay for Woman Under the Influence, and I was like, oh, this is all on the page. Like, this is not improvised, because that's what I assumed, too. But I'm sure there has to be some improvisation happening, and, like, who can say whether those scripts were written after the movie was filmed, and then who's like, I wrote this.
Yeah.
But I do think a lot more of it is written than people sometimes give him credit for, and I don't know, maybe we have to talk about Jenna Rollins, too. I'm sure she's very instrumental in shaping dialogue for her character, specifically. But yeah, super interesting.
That is, huh. I mean, there are certain scenes in particular where I was like, there's no way anyone scripted that. Like the Peter Piper scene. Feels like.
I love that so much.
I think so. It's about 2/3 of the way in.
Mm-hmm.
Jenna Rollins, after the Jenna Rollins character and the John Marley character have spent the night together, there's an interaction that's, it's all kind of subtextual, right?
Yep.
And so she's kind of reciting this nonsense tongue twister. And it doesn't feel to me watching it that anything was scripted. It was like he gave the characters motivation and they had to kind of work out the scene. But it's also possible that everything was scripted and they knew exactly where it was going. But yeah, that's kind of my reaction to everything in this movie. It's like the dialogue feels so incidental, right? The dialogue is so secondary to the emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of curious to hear what you think about the acting style in this movie and, like, which actors really do well under this kind of filmmaking style where you aren't going to get a lot of expository dialogue and where, yeah, you have to kind of... the performances have to be pitched a certain way in order for them to play. And so... Kate, I know you mentioned John Morley is not your favorite. I had the same reaction, too.
Yeah. I think part of it is, like, looking at him and Lynn Carlin together, I'm just like, they're not married. Like, this is an old man.
Yeah.
And I realize it's 68 and, like, marriage is different and different age gaps. But, like, I don't know, man. I don't fully buy them as a married couple in this. He seems so much older than she is.
Isn't there, like, there a line of dialogue where he's like, I'm still young, or there's something with the guy, and I just, like, scoffed at it in my apartment.
Like, you're not. You look like a grandpa.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting. On that note of, like, no expository dialogue, one of my favorite things about every Cassavetes movie is they just start. We just arrive in the middle of a scene, and there's no establishment of character or what their normal lives are like. We're just kind of dropped into this world, and like you were talking about subtext, we're just left to figure everything out subtextually, and I love that. I love that it breaks the rule of, like, here's your protagonist, here's their everyday life, now they're gonna meet their antagonist, and, like, all of those things exist in Cassavetes movies, but we just get there very differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Michelle, what was your reaction as someone, I don't know how familiar you were... I guess I should ask you, did you know what you were in for when you started?
So I knew a little bit about his movies. I knew more about Woman Under the Influence because that's so well known. Faces a little bit less so. Like, I didn't know the opening to this movie with them sitting down to watch the movie. That was totally new to me. I thought that was really cool. But very little as far as Faces went.
Okay.
So it was nice, you know, getting to watch something and not having kind of a preconceived notion about it. I think that makes the performances stronger for me to not know what I'm in store for.
Sure, yeah. And how was it kind of orienting yourself?
I, like Kate said, I too love when you're just dropped into the middle of a movie. I tend to like movies where it's like, oh, thank God you're not doing that 3 or 4 act structure thing where I'm like, oh, it's 20 minutes into the movie, this needs to happen, and oh, if we've hit the halfway point, where's, like, the turning point gonna be, where the climax or whatever. I like when things just unfold. I also really love movies with ambiguous endings. I love when things aren't neatly tied up, or, you know, that's not life. Like, life isn't perfect like that, so I enjoy when filmmakers just let things go like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. To your point, Kate, about sort of the unconventional structure, and maybe we can delve into specifics about how the film tells its story, because, I mean, I sort of synthesized it in a way, but I had to kind of gloss over so much, and it feels almost like the events of the movie feel almost incidental, because it's, again, I just don't feel like it's about that. So, one, what is the film about to you, and how do you kind of, how do you process everything that's happening so that you can, like, where is the meaning coming from for you?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I think the idea that we're all so fucked up in relationships, despite everyone's best intentions and, you know, love that exists at the beginning of a relationship, any kind of long-term monogamy just has certain problems that are gonna become apparent for any couple, even the best of us. So it's interesting to me that this movie is kind of, and I would say Woman Under the Influence too, is kind of meeting those problems of domesticity head on and showing them at their absolute worst, but then we get these kind of glimmers of them at their absolute best too. And just kind of setting the needle on what you can live with, the kind of things that we decide to live with, when we decide to let go of something, when we decide to hold on to something, and just, you know, living with the imperfection of relationships, if there is a foundation of love there to support that.
Damn. Yeah, I mean, so I think you're basically spot on, right? But do we end up rooting for our central couple? I'm guessing, I know.
Yeah, I know, that's a tough one.
Yeah, I'd like to hope that she, like, finds Chet again.
Yeah, they seem, like, to have a real connection.
Sexy adventures with Chet.
I'd watch that.
Yeah. Maybe. My professor, Reed Schultz, was like, guys, you don't even know how hot Seymour Cassell is about to be in this movie. You've only seen him in Wes Anderson movies. which I thought was super funny. Yeah, but I'm not rooting for them to stay together. I mean, there's the ambiguity of, like, they're probably going to stay together for a while, but I don't necessarily think that this couple stays together for the long haul.
Yeah.
Or he has, like, a massive heart attack and keels over at the dinner table, which seems just as likely as any option.
Sure. It could happen. You don't know.
Yeah. I think we'd all be okay with that. Yeah. The film... Part of my issue with the film is that it's sort of, it has this very compelling presence in Jenna Rollins, right? Like, she's a star. But she, again, is, I don't know that she is as well-rounded of a character as either of the two leads. And that's okay. I don't know that she needs to be. But part of me also wants to go back to her and find out what happened to her.
Jeannie.
Yeah. Jeannie.
When she was like, I'm 28, and she's like, no, I mean, I'm 23. I was like, oh shit, I'm 28. yeah. And just like her whole origin story and like what has gotten her to this point in her life is so interesting. And I would love to see that, in an alternate universe.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, let's talk about kind of Cassavetes' general portrayal of women, and maybe we should save this for the Woman Under the Influence section, but I think, it's notable that his primary protagonist throughout his work is Jenna Rollins, right? Like, she worked with him over and over again. And so there is this interest in femininity, but how do you think the portrayals hold up over time? I guess we'll talk specifically as it pertains to faces.
Yeah. It's interesting. I do think Cassavetes is kind of a low-key feminist, because I think a lot of what he does in terms of portraying male behavior is showing how toxic and awful it is. And a lot of times the female characters in the film, even though they are just as flawed as the male characters, you end up rooting for them. It becomes easier to root for them because they don't have these kind of, like, I don't know. It's the difference between what female aggression looks like and male aggression looks like. I don't know. It was interesting watching Jeannie. I totally agree with you, Lady P, that her Jeannie feels a little bit slight, especially even, I would say, compared to Chet. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because obviously he would go on to give her these, like, incredibly full, nuanced roles, but this is their first major collaboration in film, and this part, it's like, yeah, Jeannie's cool, and we understand the kind of life she's had to get her to this point, and we start to see the cracks in that exterior as the film goes on, but at the same time, there is this desire to delve deeper into her and see what more of what she is like on her own, because, you know, she has to be a certain level of a smooth operator, like Chet, because they're kind of hustler sex workers. But she's got rougher edges, and I want to see more about those rougher mm-hmm. edges.
Mm-hmm. Is Chet a gigolo?
I think Chet is a gigolo. Okay.
I thought so, yeah. That was the impression I got.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I guess, no, you're right, that Chet is ultimately, he gets to be the hero, right? Just back to kind of the weird kind of, it's almost episodic in its structure, right? I mean, how do you, Michelle, as a first timer, how did you how did you piece everything together? Did you even try?
It took a while.
Yeah.
I had to figure out what was going on, and then I think it really was after when he says, I want a divorce, I kind of was like, oh, okay, this is what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But before that, it really was kind of, where is this movie heading?
Yeah.
Once we picked it, I went, oh, I'm not gonna read, like, the plot description. I didn't want to go into it like that. So it is a little bit, it is episodic, actually. I mean, you could, like, break that up into not necessarily like TV shows, but, you know, like, little 30-minute bits, and I think it would still play out well.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely kind of takes you a little bit to orient yourself into the story. But I appreciate that he trusts his audience enough to do that, and he's not dumbing it down for people, and I really think that's something you don't see a lot anymore, mm-hmm. which is nice.
Absolutely, yeah. I did want to ask you, why do you think it's called Faces? I always thought that it's a curious title. I think there's a reason for it, right?
Yeah.
But it also feels a little bit arbitrary.
Yeah, it's very general.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think this is him playing with his style as a director, and obviously he'd made Shadows, but then he had kind of his, like, lost decade of making studio movies he wasn't happy with, and then returning to this is him doing what he wanted to do. I don't know. To me, it's always just been all of the glorious close-ups. I mean, the whole kind of, like, Cassavetes repertory company, like, there's a lot of mugs in that group, yes, man. Like, yeah. A lot of just interesting-looking people.
Yep.
And I mean, I think, too, kind of taking this verite approach where the entire frame is filled with just somebody's not even whole face some of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine in 68 going to see this and just being like, whoa, this does not look like domestic dramas I have seen before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is still pretty bold, right? Let's talk about how it holds up. I mean, we can see the lineage of Cassavetes in contemporary filmmakers, but I still, there is something very kind of its time also, would you say? I don't know. Michelle, what do you think? Did you see it as kind of an artifact, or do you think that it still holds a lot of resonance?
I mean, I think the core emotions and ideas of that movie still hold up, for sure. I mean, some of it's a little bit very 60s, mm-hmm. feels dated, but I think the emotional part of it is still, you know, the main thing that people take from it, and that's timeless.
Sure, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I guess for me, some of it, like, it feels like very kind of, I guess the approach to acting.
Yeah, it does feel like, in that 60s, not methody, but like, you know what I'm saying?
It's sort of like an alternative to method. It's not method exactly, because I think he was sort of a rival.
Is it Stanislavski that's the sense memory that you're like tapping into sense memories? I think that's the primary approach.
You can tell it's very like a studio acting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this movie in context of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which had come out the year before and was, like, a huge hit. Black and White, obviously, also about a disintegrating marriage. And I love Virginia Woolf. I think it's amazing.
I would not allow you to throw any shade on
that. No, it's wonderful. Okay. But it's interesting to see kind of, like, the studio version of a disintegrating marriage and the independent version of a disintegrating marriage. And, like, they both have so many merits on their own. I'm so glad they both exist in the world. But I'm curious, like, if people saw this thinking that they were going to get another kind of, like, slick Virginia Woolf-esque marriage drama, or they remembered Cassavetes from Shadows and came into it with, like, a more open mind. But yeah, I'm sure it was very strange to see this movie in 68 and be like, wait a minute.
Yeah. I would be interested in the people who knew him as an actor and then went in to go see his directed films thinking they were getting, like, that studio fare.
Yeah.
And
totally,
just,
yeah,
you know, being completely either, you know, confused or blown away, or I think that's interesting too.
Totally. And how game are these actors, right?
Totally.
Like, everyone has to be on the same page, right? Yeah. And I'm gonna be right up in here with my camera,
yeah,
right? it might get a little messy, but, like, I'm gonna need you to just keep playing out this scene because I'm just gonna keep shooting, right?
Yeah.
And everyone's just kind of gotta be on board, and it's kind of amazing. It's nice. It must be nice to be really well connected and have, like, all your friends ready to just do this for you, you know?
Yeah. The, like, family approach to independent film is so interesting, because I feel like when we talk about independent film now, we're talking about, you know, $20 million movies that
sure,
have some,
yeah,
some
you
finance.
Need one,
yeah,
one name to get the finance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But here it's just like, nope, I remortgaged our house, Jenna, and you're going to do all your own makeup, and the kids are going to be in it, and, like, it's we're going to reuse all of our friends over and over again, and, like, I can't imagine what those sets were like.
Totally. Unbelievable. Who's doing the crafty? Do you think Jenna did the crafty?
I think she, like, she, like, maybe did some of it and then was like, fuck this.
Yeah.
You gotta get the
do
rest.
Do your own crafty. Yeah. All right. Were there anything else that we wanted to talk about before I ask the last question for this?
I mean, Lynn Carlin's amazing. This is such a fabulous
performance.
Did we
talk about her
enough? We didn't talk about Lynn Carlin
enough,
I think.
She's so good in this. She, like, breaks my heart in it.
Oh, God. Also, all of her friends that she goes to the club with, and I don't remember all of their characters' names, but the arrival home from the, like, hip happening beat club, and just the way that that devolves into just these super sad married women who are just having this, like, one night of fun, and, like, Chet is kind of playing all of them and is reading all of them really well. That sequence is just fucking devastating, man.
Yeah.
Like, and Lynn Carlin, I don't know why she didn't do more.
Yeah.
Like, I expected her when I saw this, I was like, oh, she's probably just, like, an unsung actress I don't know about, but, like, her filmography, I'm like, what happened, girl?
Yeah.
She was so good.
Yeah, I wish I had that answer.
Yeah.
But she's still around. Do you think we should reach out?
Maybe, man.
Yeah. Hey, what are you doing?
See if she thinks Faces holds up.
Yeah. I'd be curious to hear.
Yeah.
She, again, like you said, nominated for an Academy Award. Didn't do anything else. Or not much else.
She's in that Bob Clark movie Death Dream, also with John Marley, I think, that I've always meant to see and have never seen, which is, like, Monkey's Paw about a boy who's killed in Vietnam. But yeah, you just wonder about some of these people. You're like, where did you go? There's a couple women in Cassavetes movies like that, like, is it Zora Lampert, who's also in Let's Scare Jessica to Death, and it's just fabulous, and you're like, where did you go? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a very specific mode of filmmaking, and that may not translate to
other.
Like, I don't even know if she had an agent when she was casting this, because she was an assistant at the production office. I'm like, you'll do.
I
love that. That just makes me love it more.
Yeah, so fearless. Especially as compared to all the other performances. And I think that's why her performance sticks out so much, is because, like, everyone else is, like, very clearly doing acting, right? They're, they're trained in a certain mode, and she's just there. She's very present, and very game for everything, and, like, I think she kind of carries the movie.
She, I feel like she's the emotional center of the movie, for sure, and, like, in the end when she kind of reconciles with John Marley, you're like, no, you can do better.
Yeah. I want her to strike out on her own. Yeah. And, like, go rule the world.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
Okay, well, on that note, let's ask the final question. So this is the 183rd movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll. It's at this point, it's hard to say whether or not it deserves that spot. But just for the record, it's tied with E.T., The Conversation. Speaking of Coppola, Out of the Past, I Was Born But, and a handful of others. I think the number of them tie for those spots. But what do we think? I'm just going to ask more generally, as opposed to like pinpointing 183. What do you think of the legacy of this film and its continued critical adoration and just generally its kind of place in the cinematic pantheon?
It's interesting. I feel like when people talk about Cassavetes, they talk about his style, the kind of like working with Jenna Rollins, that collaboration. But in terms of specifics, I feel like people only ever really talk about Woman Under the Influence or, strangely enough, Gloria, I feel like are the two that get talked about the most. But I feel like this one and Shadows don't get talked about, and Husbands really, too, really don't get talked about in the same way. And I don't know if that's because people feel like they're dated or they've just kind of fallen out of fashion or there hasn't been, like, a good enough Cassavetes retro in a minute. But it's... I don't know. It's 183 is interesting to me because, like, I think this film probably deserves to be on the list, but in terms of placement, you're like you're saying, it's so arbitrary. You know, is this 43 spots worse than Woman Under the Influence? Yeah, exactly. With the Cassavetes legacy, it's always curious because I feel like we talk about, you know, the style, the approach, the filmmaking. But talking about specific films kind of gets swept under the rug. And we shouldn't be doing that. We should be calling out great performances in these movies more specifically.
Yeah, yeah. Michelle, what do you think?
I definitely agree. It should be on the list, like Kate was saying and you were saying. It's so hard to, you know, oh, should it be 185 or like 172? I don't know. If you ask me to rank anything, it's always really hard for me to rank things because it's such a strange system of playing favorites, but like you were saying, it is kind of a thing I hear overall with Cassavetes is more talking about his general body of work than specifics, so it's nice to kind of have at least a list where you can highlight this film and that performance.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, I'm gonna let that be the final word on Faces for now, but we'll be back with Woman Under the Influence. Wars have come and wars gone. History goes on. Ever since this world began, love. Next up, we have John Cassavetes' 1974 film, A Woman Under the Influence. Like Faces, A Woman Under the Influence features Jenna Rollins crafting a character from half-improvised dialogue, or perhaps not improvised dialogue, we don't know, and heightened gestures. Here she plays Mabel, a sweet-natured mother of three, who doesn't seem to grasp some of the basic norms of social interaction. Her husband, Nick, played by Peter Falk, begrudgingly tolerates Mabel's eccentricities, except on occasions where Mabel has inappropriate interactions with other men. After a particularly bad encounter with another dad from the neighborhood, Nick and his mother have Mabel committed to a 6-month stint at a mental hospital, where she is isolated from her children and made to undergo shock treatment. When Mabel returns home, Nick is initially optimistic that he will, at long last, have a wife that behaves appropriately at parties and knows how to properly interact with other people. However, his expectations are soon dashed, as Mabel is unable to keep up any kind of pretense that she understands what it means to be a normal woman living in American society. We can talk about some of the broader implications of the film, or we can stick to just their relationship. But Cassavetes and Rollins worked together several times over the course of their respective careers and their personal relationship. They were married. But many consider A Woman Under the Influence to be the crowning achievement of their long-standing collaboration. It is the highest ranked of Cassavetes' films on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, landing in the 144th spot. Much has changed both in terms of how society views mental illness and the way it contends with atypical personality types since the release of this film. But does this film fall in line with how the way contemporary society is dealing with some of these issues, or does it bear the mark of its time? Maybe both. We shall discuss. Okay, so initial thoughts. Michelle, I'm going to start with you. Yeah. Once again, the newbie.
Yep.
What'd you think?
I really loved this movie. I loved Gina Rowland's performance in it. I thought Peter Falk is really great in this. And your heart just breaks for both of them in such different ways. I think it's such a good character study. And it's in some ways a very quiet movie, and in other ways it's not a quiet movie at all. And I kind of love movies like that, that are just these very small looks at, you know, this family and what they're dealing with. I think it's the performance is what makes this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Kate?
Yeah, I mean, just to put a fine point on it, this is my favorite performance by any actor in anything.
Okay.
I think Jenna Rollins is God, is a force of nature. There's the story that Cassavetes wanted to do this as a play, and she was like, you're out of your mind. And so that's why they did it as a feature. But just, I don't know, the level of emotional transparency, the physical gestures, the delivery of lines, the chemistry she has with Peter Falk, who is also just, like, career best here, it's just a transcendent experience. This is, I would say, maybe one of my five favorite movies of all time. It's incredible. It was the second Cassavetes movie I saw, and it's just one of those movies that I think once you see it, you never forget it. I don't know how anyone could forget her work in this film.
Sure, yeah. I'm worried about all the angry Columbo fans that you
come at me. Columbo's great, too. It's fine, guys.
Yeah. It's a good thing I used to watch with my grandmother.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's really pretty underrated as an actor. I know we toss around that term a lot, but what he's doing here is equally important as what Jenna's doing. I know she gets to be the bigger presence, kind of. I mean, he gets to do a lot of yelling himself, but there's something, like, she gets to be more unpredictable, right? Like, she's the one everyone's kind of uneasy with. Right. And it's such a distinctive performance. You don't see mental illness portrayed in this way very often. Right. But I did, one of the things that struck me upon this viewing, as opposed to my initial viewing, was like, we have talked, because of the rise of social media, there's just generally, and other factors, there's just generally more awareness of mental illness in society. I'd like to think so anyway. And so, I don't know that you could make this movie today, because, I don't know, I think there's something about her, the way that she depicts whatever is happening with her that just wouldn't fly. And I know I'm being a little bit vague, but I think it's because the performance isn't, it isn't that specific, right? She's just kind of, like, a little bit off. Right? She's kind of kooky.
I feel like today they would be like, this is her diagnosis. Yes, totally, like, they would give it so much exposition to explain what she's going through. And in this film, they just let her be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's also the question, too, of whether or not Mabel Longhetti is actually mentally ill, or she's just really eccentric and she's just kind of a very unique personality. And is it the world that's wrong, or is it Mabel that's wrong? And I mean, that's definitely kind of what Nick starts reckoning with in the last third of the movie. I also found myself with this viewing really asking myself if Mabel has always been like this, and Nick knew that when he married her because she was pregnant.
That's what I was wondering, yeah.
Or it's been a development as she's just been a, kind of crushed by, you know, him working long hours, her being left alone with the children, having this kind of, you know, I would say borderline personality to begin with. I was really thinking about that with this viewing in terms of, is this been a progression with Mabel, or has Mabel just always been Mabel?
Yeah, no, that's definitely worth considering, for sure. I don't know, what is your inclination? It would just be a guess, but
yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would think the way the film treats that first beat with them, that he is unable to come home from work and they've been planning this date night, and she acts out in such a huge way by, you know, picking up a man at the bar who effectively rapes her when they come back to her home, and the fact that she brings him to her family home to have sex with him, would suggest that, you know, their marriage has been rocky for quite a while, and that Nick feels like he has something to prove to her in kind of this romantic way. I don't know. I feel like my take on where Mabel lies in terms of, like, diagnosable mental illness changes every time I watch the movie based on, like, my mood. So,
yeah.
Yeah. But it is interesting to consider. I definitely think that whatever Mabel was before she got married has been exacerbated in ways both good and bad by being a wife and mother.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely something interesting to think about.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Part of this movie is obviously just about the specifics of their dynamic, Nick and Mabel's dynamic, but also there are, I think, some broader implications about the way that we treat women, right? And the way that, and the kind of very 1960s, or it's actually 1970s, like very second wave feminism
mm-hmm.
kind of inflected ideas about women's work and women's isolation and stuff like that. So, I don't know, Michelle, did any of that stuff occur to you as you were watching?
Yeah, I was, if you didn't know, this is my first time watching it. So I do feel like it is a movie where I need to have multiple viewings to mm-hmm. really get the full sense of it. But you can definitely get that, you know, the biggest thing that I took out of this movie was that feeling of isolation and aloneness. Just, you know, she's, maybe for her, you know, all of this is sane and completely fine actions, and just watching her movements around other people was kind of what I enjoyed most about it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you definitely get that sense of it, especially it's a movie that I think ages very well, but also feels like very of its time mm-hmm. period.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Not just because of the costumes.
Yeah. No, but there is this kind of sense, like you mentioned, second wave feminism, of like women finally starting to be like, no, I'm tired of this. Like,
mm-hmm.
my job as a housewife is exhausting, and no one is acknowledging that. And I think that comes through, like, in the scene where she's waiting for her kids to come home from school and waiting for the bus stop and asking everyone for the time. And she just comes off as this total kind of loony on the street, but you're like, man, if I was, like, building my day around when my children got home from school, I would be extremely high-key about it, too.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
you'd be on edge all day.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I mean, this movie is such a good study in both Nick and Mabel, because everything that they do, you can justify in two ways. I feel like every action kind of is able to have a very nuanced, kind of a very nuanced tale in terms of how you view it, and so much is contingent on, I feel like, the viewers' relationships, what kind of, you know, interpersonal romantic things they've dealt with. But yeah, it's just such a fascinating character study and study of a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
It's so timeless. Like, I think whatever happens to the rest of Cassavetes's legacy, like, we're gonna be talking about this one until the aliens abduct us all.
Sure, yeah. Lord willing. Yeah, I think what's you're right, it is a study in both Mabel and Nick, and in some ways, the film's real focus is on kind of the fragile masculinity of Nick,
mm-hmm.
right? We really get a sense that, like, of his kind of shame, that he can't, that his wife doesn't, has sort of disappointed him in some way, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you get the infamous spaghetti dinner sequence where Nick is asking her to perform and make this giant meal for his coworkers that he just shows up with. But then when she starts being Mabel within the context of that, he loses his shit.
Yeah.
And it's like, Nick, this is exactly what you asked for. If you didn't want this to happen, then you
yeah.
shouldn't have asked her to make spaghetti dinner for 30 people.
Right. You
yeah.
knew what you were getting into.
Yeah. And I mean, the way she's acting out in that specific moment is so harmless. Just the, like, singing songs and the stuff about the guy with the really handsome face. And he just goes to 11 on that. And then, so it makes that second beat with the father of the neighboring children so much scarier when it escalates to physical violence between Nick and him, and I definitely think that's fragile masculinity of, like, oh, you're viewing my wife as an insufficient caregiver, which means it's reflecting on me as a bad husband, like, what am I not giving her that she's an insufficient caregiver? And that sequence is just so harrowing. Mm-hmm. This movie is tough, y'all.
Should we talk about the mother, who is played by Cassavetes' actual mother?
Catherine Cassavetes is playing Nick's mom, and then Lady Rollins is playing Jenna's mom, which is very cool. Yeah. And then
we have the same first name. Strong turns all through throughout, right? Like, even the children, especially, is it Zoe?
I never remember which is which on the daughters. Yeah. I can't keep which one is Zan and which one is Zoe straight. Okay. We're both very cool, accomplished filmmakers in their own right now as adults, which is really amazing. as is Nick, too. We should shout him out.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we did shout out The Notebook earlier.
That's true.
I want to know how he created an environment where everyone is just free to deliver whatever, you know, like, just a very open, free, expressive set, right? So let's talk about Cassavetes more generally. I know we touched on this in the Faces conversation, but let's talk about his evolution as a filmmaker, mm-hmm. and why do we think this one is stronger than Faces, if we do. I'm gathering we do.
I do, yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree that this is the crowning achievement. Like, I think that there are other absolutely fabulous, timeless Cassavetes movies, but if you had to explain his style as a filmmaker to somebody, or just kind of convey his legacy, I think this is the movie you show them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting to watch kind of the evolution from Shadows to, you've got the decade of studio movies, and then he comes back with Faces, and then makes Husbands and Minnie and Moskowitz in between this and Woman Under the Influence. And to me, Woman Under the Influence is kind of like the maturity leap that we then get Killing of a Chinese Bookie and Opening Night, where we're playing a little bit more with style and influence. But yeah, I find this to be such a relatable film. I don't think there's a person alive who wouldn't be moved by something in this film, even if they find, you know, I've heard the complaint that it's off-putting to watch these two scream at each other for 2.5 hours, which I don't really get. But just, you know, you connect to the mother characters or the doctor character or Nick's coworkers, or, you know, there's that terrible moment where there's the accident with Nick at work, and that's such a tragic moment. Cassavetes is always so good at giving you multiple ways into any story, and I think that's one of the, like, benefits of not having a traditional script with a single protagonist, is you can, like, find something to hook into.
Sure. Yeah. Are either of you Bergman fans?
Here's a terrible confession. Oh, no. I've seen one Bergman movie.
I've seen a few, but I wouldn't say I'm an expert on him.
Okay, yeah. I guess this time, watching it through, I was like, this has a lot of the kind of emotional violence of a Bergman movie, but it's...
I can see that, yeah.
Well, and then there's the joke in Faces about, like, oh, there's a new Bergman movie. Yeah. And it's like, oh, it's just gonna make you depressed. Yeah. Yeah.
Not a lie.
But... as far as American filmmakers go, there aren't that many that kind of delve into that make you feel the way that this movie makes you feel.
Yeah.
It's like, really, there's no catharsis at any point, right? There's very little satisfaction, right? You're just kind of left with the sadness. I don't know, we were talking earlier about ambiguous endings and sort of open-ended stories, and what do you guys make of the ending? I guess I'll ask you the similar question that we touched on for Faces, like, are you rooting for these two? And if so, what makes them more sympathetic?
I think you do, but I wouldn't necessarily say, hey, their story, they're going to come out all right on the end of this. Those kids, I believe
in them.
They're
going to make it. Yeah.
But, you know, they have this relationship and they really have an understanding with each other. You wonder if it's going to survive that, but you want it to stay if it can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's that kind of indefinable thing that happens sometimes in couples, like, to give two real-life examples, we've gotten the docs about Whitney Houston and Kurt Cobain in the past couple of years, and both of those include footage of Kurt and Courtney Love, and then Whitney and Bobby Brown. And from the outside, those relationships look very turbulent and chaotic and terrible. And then you see these home movies of these people, and you're like, wait a minute, there's something really genuine here and really special. And I think that's kind of what the Longettis have, even though the relationship is very toxic in many ways and codependent in many ways. You do find yourself at the end of the day being like, yeah, you make that bet. Like, you just keep going about your daily lives because, like, there is no other person for you than this other person here, even with all of the bad that entails. I would say part of it, too, is it's much easier to root for Peter Falk than it is for John Marley, I think.
Yeah, like, I agree with that.
Especially as Nick sort of pivots in the end of the movie to be like, no, it's you guys who are crazy. Mabel is fine. This is my wife. This is the mother of my children. And kind of embraces his own, quote-unquote, craziness and how that corresponds with her own mental health issues. Yeah, you feel like these two are kind of just like salt and pepper shakers. Mm-hmm. They're just gonna be stuck together forever.
I mean, I guess, especially after this viewing, I did kind of question whether, whether Mabel was in fact mentally ill. Two, whether it wasn't Nick who was the one who was mentally ill, right? Like, his actions have actual consequence, right? Whereas she's not hurting anyone, right? The kids are fine.
Yeah, I mean, there's that throwaway line about, like, the kids are running around naked and my mother hates it. And it's like, okay, but that's your mom who is, like, a real villain in this movie. Yeah, and I mean, I think that's the question, too, of, like, has Mabel always been this way, or has Mabel been shaped by the marriage with Nick and to make her more unstable? And that's something really interesting to think about. I don't know that there's supposed to be a right answer, and it's so contingent on your personal experiences, and that's exactly what Cassavetes wants the movie to do, I think.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. The mother character, we were sort of circling back to this because we've touched on it already, but that's another way that it kind of feels... I don't know. Do you think that's a nuanced performance? Like, she is the villain, right? Like, she is the one sticking up for propriety and, like, you dress your children. Like, what's wrong with you? But is there a defense of the mother, of the grandmother?
I mean, I think it's the idea that, like, anybody outside looking in on any kind of those situations is likely to only respond to the bad parts or the sensationalistic parts of it. And I think that's kind of what she's doing. She's only seeing it from the outside. It is tough to sympathize with her. I mean, Lady Rollins is easy to sympathize with as the grandma in the beginning who's, like, taking the kids for the sleepover so that Mabel and Nick can have this romantic evening. But it is definitely harder to connect, I would say, with Nick's mother in this movie, and I don't know if that is, you know, Cassavetes working out his own issues with his mother, or just kind of the archetypal mother, but I mean, in the end, I would say that Nick ultimately sides with Mabel over his mother, and that's a powerful choice, that really defines, I think, how their relationship will continue going forward.
Okay. So, anything else that we want to touch on before I ask the final question? I feel like this section was shorter than Faces, but it's, I think, because we got a lot of the general stuff.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, I wanted to talk a little bit about how cool it was that he worked with so many members of the AFI Conservatory. So we've got Caleb Deschanel and Frederick Elms, who had gone to be awesome DPs and directors doing, like, camera stuff on this, which is super cool. And the fact that I believe this is the first movie that was ever actually independently distributed, because the story is that Cassavetes couldn't get anybody to pick it up, so he just started calling theaters in LA and asking them to run it, and, like, that's where we get the idea of four-walling comes from this film, and that's really amazing. Like, talk about a true independent spirit, and, like, how far that independent film label has changed from, you know, 1974, when this was literally, like, Cassavetes with Prince of the Trunk, the movie in the trunk of his car, being like, hey, will you show this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no way that would happen to you ever.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that this was nominated for Best Actress and Best Director and no Best Picture. It's, you know, I love Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, and I love Ellen Burstyn, but the fact that she stole Jenna's Oscar for this, I will never forgive. Yeah, and, but that was kind of Ellen Burstyn's only real shot, too. Yeah, you just, it's funny to think about what kind of performances the Academy Awards versus what performances really stand the test of time, and, you know, I don't, even if you don't like this movie, I don't know how you could watch it and be like, Jenna Rollins does a bad job in this movie.
Has anyone ever said that? That's kind of like, you know, Marlon Brando in The Godfather.
I've never heard that.
Yeah. yeah, and she's just, God, she's so fucking good in this. I mean, I don't think there's any praise that's too much for her in this. She's absolutely incredible, and I think still one of the greatest actresses of all time that doesn't necessarily get talked about when we're having the conversation about the greatest. We should all be so lucky to have a creative, collaborative partnership that yields this much beautiful art.
Absolutely, yeah. No, and you're right. We have not done enough fawning over Jenna Rollins.
Yeah.
Did you say Gina or Jenna?
I say Jenna. Okay. That's what I've heard.
I thought it was Gina, but I could be 100% wrong. Yeah.
When I got actually to meet her a couple years ago at the New Beverly, it's still like one of the coolest things that ever happened to me. They did a double feature of opening night and A Woman Under the Influence right before she got her honorary Oscar.
That's such a tough double feature.
I did not stay for Woman Under the Influence because I was like, I need to go to sleep tonight. Yeah. But it was incredible. After opening night, there were like probably 100 people outside the New Beverly, and she stopped and took photos with everybody, and it was so ironic to have seen opening night, where it's all about just, like, the fan-actor relationship. She's amazing. She smelled great. She put her arm around me. She's still wearing the, like, 2-circle diamond ring from Gloria, and it's still one of the highlights of my whole damn life, so, yeah.
That's beautiful. That's a beautiful story. I love that. Yeah, she's still with us, and we should acknowledge that.
She's the best,
yeah,
man.
She's the best. And we can all, like, I love that someday we could all just meet Jenna Rollins. Like, having, like Kate, we too could have a brush
That's
of
a goal to strive for.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So good. I also went to see her when she got her hands put in cement at Grauman's, and she did one of the, like, Mabel Longhetti, like, gestures with her thumb, and I started weeping.
Oh.
Yeah. I was like, this is fine and normal. It's good. Yeah.
That's so great, though. I love that. Okay. So, let's get down to the nonsense, shall we? This is the 144th spot on the Sight and Sound. Or it has the 144th spot on the Sight and Sound Critics poll. Again, pretty arbitrary, right? But as far as legacy goes, this is the top-rated film of Cassavetes on the Sight and Sound list. What do we think? And I guess just generally, let's talk more broadly about Cassavetes as a filmmaker and how he's become more of a symbol than an actual maker of movies that people watch, right? And what does that symbol mean? What is it actually his legacy now? And how would you like to see it changed?
Yeah, it's interesting to think about, you're so dead on about him being emblematic of a movement more than he's represented with films. I think a lot of people are intimidated by the filmography and know that these films are emotionally harrowing and don't necessarily want to just jump into that, which is a shame because, like, within that emotional kind of violence, there's also so many warm, beautiful, funny, loving moments. And I think that's the true gift of Cassavetes as a filmmaker, is that he gives us these expressions of love, whether those are come out as emotional violence and hatred as love, or, you know, warmth and generosity. I'm curious to see how this film's reputation continues as, you know, time goes on. I would say for me, this is one of those movies that if anybody is making a list of, like, the top 100, I think this should be on every one of those lists. I'd say, like, 144 seems low to me, because I think if we're talking about paradigms that pushed American independent film forward. Like, this is maybe the key example. Maybe something like Night of the Living Dead as well. But this is just such a radical, you know, we're getting the band together, we made a movie in a house, it stars my wife and our children and our mothers. And we just made this kind of timeless expression of what it means to be a family, that's going to echo through the ages. So yeah, I mean, I definitely agree that this is the best Cassavetes movie and the one that we should talk about the most. But I do hope that people delve deeper in his filmography, because you've got, you know, something like Killing of a Chinese Bookie, which gives you Ben Gazzara's, I would say, career best role, or something like Husbands that still feels like such a damning indictment of shitty male behavior 45 years later. I just hope we don't forget those things when we talk about him as being like Mr. Independent Film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it. Michelle?
I think it definitely deserves a slot. I agree, he's more... When I think of Cassavetes, I don't necessarily think of a specific film. He is that kind of symbol of that independent era, mm-hmm. Which is kind of a shame in some ways, and that's, you know, what has taken me so long to maybe dive into his filmography is not necessarily being intimidated by it, but it's almost like, well, where do you start? Mm-hmm. It's so varied, and, you know, is there a certain order I should watch it, or, you know, what it does feel like a movie that takes a lot out of you. Mm-hmm. It's an experience for sure. I would be really interested, you know, like, get back to us 20, 30 years from now, and what does Cassavetes look like then? Mm-hmm. Are people still, you know, knock on wood, people are still watching his movies, but, like, sure. What are the ones that float to the top, like, you know, with time, mm-hmm. certain, you know, Spielberg is one I always talk mm-hmm. about, is, like, his filmography, what people look at, has changed so much over time, mm-hmm. and completely different filmmakers, but it's interesting to see, like, hey, you know, 20 years from now, are people going to be, like, super into Opening Night and, like, Love Streams mm-hmm. is, like, his, like, kind of coming yeah. back a little bit now, because it's on Criterion, and that's become a thing, so it's kind of crazy to see what from his filmography stands out for people now. Mm-hmm. I'd be interested Absolutely. To see like young film students now, like, yeah. what they think of his films.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely.
I don't think they connect with his films. I'm like, I'm not. Trying to envision.
I wonder if yeah. they feel dated to film students now, but it's such like he's dealing with such core emotions that, you know, everybody taps into. Mm-hmm. That's what I think endures with him.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I'm teaching production next semester, so I'll show it and let you know. We'll
yeah.
see.
Do.
We'll see
yeah.
how it goes.
I would love
yeah.
to see what they think.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I feel like when we watched it in film school, there were like 10 of us who were like, this is the best thing I've ever seen. And then the rest of the class was just like, that was boring.
yeah.
It's like, okay.
It yeah. was yeah. every movie yeah. Yeah. at my film school.
Cool yeah. take. Yeah.
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 All right. Well, yeah, I'll report back, I suppose.
Please do.
Yeah. Actually, before I set off, I do quickly just want to say, Opening Night is my favorite Cassavetes film, and
I've heard that from a lot of people.
Yeah.
Actually,
it's incredible. Yeah. yeah. I mean, it was like I have really interesting relationships with Cassavetes movies. Like, the first time I watched that, I was like, I don't like this one that much. Like, this is lower on my list. And then I saw it a second time, and I was like, nope, super wrong. That one is so interesting, though, and I would say the other best Jenna performance yeah. in kind of the Cassavetes canon. Mm-hmm. And that one feels crazy modern to me still. Yeah. That's turning 40 this year, I think, right? Is that 78?
Was it 78?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, maybe we should do another episode. Just on opening night. Good oh, gracious. Man. All right, yeah. we'll put it on the calendar. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise. That is, listeners, what's your favorite Cassavetes film? Come leave us a note on our website, flickswise.com, or on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flickswise. If you want to gush over Jenna Rollins with me, then you should probably come find me on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. And the social media is also the best way for you to check for updates on upcoming episodes and for just general updates on the goings-on here at FlixWise. I know we have a Third Man episode coming up, and I think The Grand Illusion is probably also coming up. But since we're going out of order now, it can be harder to tell. But There's also likely a handful of other FlixWise favorites coming up and FlixWise Canada. So, yeah, check back for details. Until then, Michelle, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for inviting me.
Just real quickly, where can people find you on the internet?
Twitter is probably the best place. I'm at Michelle Deirdre, MichelleDeirdre.
Perfect. And Kate?
Yeah, likewise, Twitter. I am at That Hagen Girl, THATHAGENGRRL. You can also find me on Instagram and Medium under that handle.
Awesome, awesome. All right, well, until next time, will you join me for a cigarette in the stairwell?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it. All right.